You're listening to Under a Pile of Books, and I am so excited for you to get to listen to this episode. This is one of our self-published Fantasy Month specials, and in this episode, in just a few moments, you're going to hear me interview Michael J. Sullivan and his wife, Robin. Obviously, it's hard to think of a bigger name in self-publishing than Michael J. Sullivan, and Robin has so much insight into the industry and into sort of the behind-the-scenes intricacies of self-publishing. I think you're going to enjoy what she has to offer to the conversation as well. I want to take this opportunity to say a huge thank you to both Michael and Robin for giving up so much of their time to allow me to interview them and get this audio to you. So listener, I hope that you have a wonderful time with this episode. If you have half as much fun listening to it as I had talking to Michael and Robin and doing this interview, I think it'll be more than worth your time. So without further ado, here's Michael and Robin. Hey, everyone. This is Calvin, and I am here with Michael J. Sullivan, whom many of you no doubt know about and have heard of. His books are amazing and ones that I've talked about on the podcast before, and you've probably seen and heard about through various other blogs and reviewers and that sort of thing. But it's a pleasure to be here with Michael this evening, and also his wife, Robin, who may be jumping in here on a few of these questions as well. So really looking forward to diving in, and thank you so much for being here.
You're welcome. I'm glad to come by and say hi. And yeah, Robin's she's here because there's going to be some questions, I think, about the more intricacy parts of self-publishing. And she is, I consider, to be probably one of the most foremost experts in that area. So rather than me fumbling through it, I may throw a couple of those questions her way.
That's awesome. And thank you both so much for being here. So to sort of get us started here and jump in, tell us a little bit about your own journey of publishing. And we were kind of joking a little bit before we started recording here that this alone could take up, all of our time. So we'll see how it goes. But Michael, please go ahead.
Well, the problem with this is that it's kind of a long story, obviously, because it starts out when I'm 2 years old, and then I move on from there. My wife thinks that's a bad idea to start with, and do it long. So I'm going to try and give you the summary action here. So I started writing, obviously, at the age of 13, if you know anything. I think that's part of my bio now. After I got done reading Lord of the Rings, and I wanted to have more. I wrote for, about 20 years. I tried to get published doing the query go round, where I'm, mailing out to the various publishers, trying to get an agent. Actually, I never actually wrote to a publisher, I don't think. I did this for about 10 years of really dedicated work. And I wrote 13 novels during this period of time, never got anywhere. Finally, I noticed that all my friends had moved on and had careers, and I had gotten nowhere. So I finally faced the reality that I was not going to be an author because that was just not possible. So I gave that up, and I went back and joined the work world, and I actually started an advertising agency and did fairly well with that. But at some point, I just had these ideas in my head that just wouldn't go away. And I like writing. That's the whole problem, is I've always enjoyed writing. And that's it became a matter of I didn't want to write anymore because of the fact that I always felt I had to get published. So I decided I'm not going to get published. And my daughter was having trouble reading, and I got a book for her named Harry Potter, which I picked up. And for a long time, I was trying to figure out how to write. So I was reading very difficult, literary fiction or Pulitzer Prize winning books. And some of them were quite dry. And I didn't have that kind of thrill that I used to have as a kid. But when I read Harry Potter, I was like, this is what I would love to write. So I kind of went back to that. I just started writing this story about these two thieves. And I wasn't going to do it to get published, but my wife read it and she thought it was great. And she decided she was going to take over the reins of getting me published because apparently I'm not that competent at it. And this feeds directly into a segue of why she's here to handle these other questions, because she's the one who actually got me published. She's the one who went out and got the first agent. And after that, when that agent had shopped it around and didn't get anywhere satisfactory, she took over and tried to get the books self-published. And this was back in the day when we didn't have, you know, Kindle. We were literally printing them and going to sell them out of the trunk of our car. So we got to that point, and very slowly we did get before we actually got to self-publishing it, we actually found we were asked to be published by a small press in Minnesota. And they were going to publish us, which was great. So they put out the first book, and they got me a bunch of dates at bookstores, and where I did some signings. And then just as it was coming around to the second book, we found out that they had some money problems and they weren't going to be able to actually put out the second book. So we got back our rights. And from that point on, we started self-publishing the next 5 books in that series, at which point in time, we did relatively well. I mean, it was a very slow process. First book did do much. Second book did better. Third book did better. By the time I get to the fifth book, we were doing very well. And that's when my wife is named Robin, by the way, she decided to go back to New York and see if they were interested. So she did get our foreign agent to represent us domestically. She went out and we ended up getting a deal with Orbit, which is a subsidiary of Hachette. And that's how I got my first foot in the door in the big New York, at the time, the Big Six. And then from there, when we found out that they didn't want to move me up to the hardcover mass market set, we decided to then move over to Del Rey, which is a subsidiary of Random House. And that's where I did my last series through. And, well, stop there, I think.
I want to circle back to the fact that now you're back to self-publishing.
Well, yeah. Well, that's where I was going. It's because of the fact that the audiobook deals that I've been getting have been so lucrative. I have pre-sold those. And as it turned out, Random House has a corporate mandate where they will not accept anyone who without the audio as well. That was a decision that came down in the middle of my series. So the last 3 books, which they were going to pick up, they decided they couldn't because of this new problem, because I had already sold the rights to that. So as a result of that, I went back to self-publishing those, which was not a great hardship because I was already, you know, making fine money with the audio, and it really wasn't a problem.
You actually self-published the Rye Era before that.
Oh, that's right. After we finished the first 2 Chronicles, at that point in time, the next 2 we just picked up and carried on myself, just because, for obvious reasons, which we'll probably get into, there are certain benefits to self-publishing.
No, it's really, it's cool and to just kind of hear your story in a obviously very condensed format. And you talked just a little bit there about kind of your own love for writing and writing the stories and reading Tolkien or whatnot, and then later on Harry Potter, and wanting to kind of write this. When I believe I've read before, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think I've read before that you tend to kind of get the your idea for the series and almost sit down and write all the books in that series, at least in kind of a draft form, before the first one is published. Is that correct?
Not kinda. So as you just got from my story, that I was writing those first books for fun, and I was not planning on publishing them. In fact, I had a few of them on the internet for a while just for free. But I wrote every single one of the 6 books of the Rye Era Revelations, and I didn't even intend to have them published. But as it turned out, they got published. And when I got to the end of that series, I realized how fortunate it was that I was able to do that, because as we went through the editing process, I was able to go back and change small things. And as I was finishing up that last book, I realized, oh, you know what? It would be really cool if I could have just changed this one sentence in the second book. And I went, I can. So that showed me the huge benefit to actually writing the entire story out, because it would be the equivalent to literally writing a book a chapter at a time and publishing those, so you can't change anything that you've already written. And so I don't even know how other authors would go about writing a series without having the ability to kind of go back and being able to put in those checkoff guns or those little secrets that then can come to fruition later. So that was something I stumbled down by accident, but I've kept that going. And there's another benefit to that, which is I don't like working under pressure. Now, a number of first-time authors, they'll put their first book out, and then they have to come out with that sophomore book. And that's a huge problem, particularly if the first book did very well. The second book is not going to go over. You know, they have to have the second book be even better than that first one to be seen as half as good. And this is a lot of pressure for authors. And sometimes they never get that second book because of the difficulties involved in it. Where mm-hmm. I had them all done. So it didn't matter to me one way or the other. And it's kind of funny because people will say, you know, do you accept and change your story based off of the feedback of your readers? I'm like, well, no, the books are all done. They're not completely done. They are written in draft form to the point where they're 90% done. But then there are changes. My wife will find plot holes. Editors will find mistakes in the sentences. And we do polish it up. That's why it does take a while after I get done with it.
Still, that's I think that's got to be a pretty unique to have the entire series done, because you're also writing series that aren't two or even three books. Some, you know, they're five, six books. So I mean, these are pretty sizable series, and you've got them at least as a draft done before you start the process of publishing, which is really cool and a bit unique, I think. So
yeah, it just makes it easier for me. And I mean, the hard part is when I write series that connect, because I can't write several series all before I publish them. So I do have a difficult time, and I have to try and figure out ways to leave doors open that I can tap later. And sometimes that helps, and sometimes I get myself in trouble where I have to make a logical way to make something happen after the fact.
I love the different way of kind of thinking about series or whatnot, and I'm sure it's extremely useful to be able, like you said, to go back and put some of that foreshadowing in or whatnot in an earlier book, because it hasn't been published yet. Now, another thing that you kind of mentioned as you were talking and sharing some of your own journey, you've been involved in writing and having your work published in sort of different ways over the past years. So I'm curious from your perspective or perhaps Robin's as well, how you've seen self-publishing develop over the past, say, decade. You mentioned already, right, there was no Kindle. You were planning on selling things out of the trunk of your car or whatever. What are some of the ways that you've seen self-publishing develop over that time?
Well, it came into existence. that was a huge one. And then, of course, they had the Kindle, and then the iPad, and these things made it all possible. But I'm going to let Robin go into more of the intricacies for your obvious, your audience, who is probably very savvy, and she'll be able to speak to them.
So a lot of times, by the way, I happen to teach a bunch of courses on publishing. And like you said, we've been at this for over a decade now. We mm-hmm. released our first book in 2008. And, people ask me or people say how hard it is to self-publish now. And I'm like, you've got to be kidding me, because it is so much easier now than what it used to be. Back when we were self-publishing, there weren't a lot of resources for having covers designed. It was very hard to find copy editors. There was no infrastructure in place. There was no distribution system. It was very, very difficult. And I used to teach my classes and say, if you self-publish, don't expect to make any money at it. Well, long about, I would say 2011, by 2011, I think self-publishing really came into its own. And we saw a ton of authors earning very, very well. And still to this day, see authors doing very well. And there's, I kind of put self-publishing authors into two different categories. There's what I call the professional self-publishing authors. And these are the ones who are really treating it like a business. They're, they're putting out works with every bit of quality as the big five put out. I'm amazed at the self-publishing covers these days. I mean, like, if you look at some of these covers, you can't tell, a self-published cover from a traditionally published cover.
Yeah.
They have entire infrastructures for doing their, you know, their beta reads and their copy editing, and
they're doing pretty much everything the traditional publisher is doing now. Even using a lot of the same people.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And there's just more resources now. I mean, like, you know, like I said, you know, back in the day we had to do our own covers. You know, now there's many, many, many sites that offer very good covers very inexpensively. Now the thing that is always difficult, obviously, is getting noticed. And the major change I see in that respect is, and there's two different ways of doing it. I mean, we're kind of old school in the fact that we kind of built the audience literally one reader at a time, you know, very, very labor intensive, you know, but I call it the priming the pump method, you know, where you can get the book in front of enough people. And if it's good enough and they like it enough, then they tell other people and then slowly the wheels turn. These days, you know, a lot of authors are turning to paid advertising. They're spending quite a bit of money on paid advertising. And there certainly is a sense that, you know, it's more of a pay to play scenario. And I can see that perspective, but I do think that in some respects, people use that as a crutch. And if you use the old time honored techniques of write a really good book, and by really good book, I mean a book that people will tell other people they want to, you know, you should read this. And if you get it in the hands of a few people and you rinse and repeat, I think that can still work. Even, you know, it's just a different way of going about it.
Well, the good part about doing it that way, I think, besides the fact that I did it and I like to make myself feel good, is the fact that you have a wider base and you have readers who are loyal to you personally.
Yeah.
As opposed to if you're part of a, what do you call it? When you're
Kindle Unlimited.
Yeah, part of Kindle Unlimited, your people are buying that service. And oftentimes, I mean, they obviously have authors they like more than others, but I think if you weren't on that anymore, they would still read that source and not necessarily follow you. But if you're building a fan base directly to yourself, then no matter where you go, if Amazon disappeared tomorrow, you could still sell books off of your own website. So it's a greater sense of security as far as your career is concerned.
Oh, wow. That's really, that's an interesting, like I hadn't thought of it from that perspective. That's really cool. Thank you. No, kind of going along.
I didn't mean to like throw you there, but you.
No. It's just it took me a second to kind of like process that because, I think you're kind of right. The way that folks tend to use Kindle Unlimited, again, painting with broad strokes or whatnot, is very much, you know, this is a service, and you're just, you know, you're consuming the books that are available on that service because they're available on that service, you know, as opposed to maybe following specific authors or whatnot.
Yeah, for instance, none of our books are in Kindle Unlimited, and I've tried to go into Kindle Unlimited, and quite frankly, it's never really worked for us.
Okay.
Because we actually get paid less in Kindle Unlimited, and we have obviously a higher unit price than many self-published authors do. But I think sometimes that, you know, there has been, you know, a few authors who have been kicked off Kindle Unlimited and, you know, and like their fans aren't following them.
Well, no
to other platforms.
No one's ever watched a show on Netflix that they wouldn't normally watch.
Yeah, right. No one ever.
Never. You know, The Tiger King would have been just as popular if it was on ABC.
Exactly. That's right. That's 100%. So kind of with this in mind, because I know Kindle Unlimited right now is pretty big in terms of you know, kind of self-publishing and self-published authors and whatnot. Where do you kind of imagine? This is a big, huge question, and so it's really hard to answer because it's impossible to predict the future. But where do you maybe imagine self-publishing will develop over the coming years?
So there's where it will go, and what I would advise of people. And those are two different things.
Okay. But you're going to get both.
So as I said, the pay for play is really a big thing now, right? So So in some respects, authors who have done well initially and have kind of an income stream already that they can kind of filter off some of that money to the advertising world. And don't get me wrong. I mean, they're very smart about it. They do very well at it. Mm-hmm. They're investing far less than they're getting in. I know, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of authors who make six figures, and they spend really high amounts on marketing, but even after you back out their marketing costs, they're still making six figures in profit. So the problem is, I don't think that's ultimately sustainable, right? Like, it's going to be a little bit like what happened with bookstores. I don't know how much you know about bookstores, but there's something called a co-op fee. And if you've ever walked into a big store, bookstore, and you see like these books, like on these tables at the front of the store that say, you know, hot new releases. Well, those aren't hot new releases because the bookstore owner said, wow, I read this book and I think it's really good and it's really hot and I want to put it out there. Those books are on those tables because the publisher pays fees to either the bookstore chain or the bookstore themselves to have those books there.
Even just having the book face out on the shelf is the same thing.
Yeah, is also a co-op fee. So what that really meant was, you know, kind of some of the bigger players, you know, can get more eyeballs than the littler players. And I think we're seeing a lot of that now in self-publishing. And those types of systems tend to squeeze out the littler guy, right? The guy who's just starting out, doesn't have a lot of money, you know, can't, you know, I totally do not recommend that anyone go into debt to buy advertising, right? Mm, I mean, you have to grow your income organically. And I think that, you know, at some point, you know, the readers are just going to get immune to ads. You know, it's not going to be as effective as it sometimes as it was in the past.
You seem to be seeing that already, don't we?
A little bit, yeah, I do. So, but again, that said, I think there are alternate techniques. It's just that people don't use them because A, they're a lot more work, and B, they may not even think of it as a particular resource. Now, what I am all about, and one of the reasons why we self-publish, is the writing business is a very hard business. I mean, I know authors who made six figures for multiple years, and then suddenly they fell off a cliff, and now they can't make any money. And in some cases, they are in debt because they paid money for marketing, and they didn't get it back. So what I'm about is, you know, if you want to have that dream of earning from writing, then you have to be very smart about it. And what I am working towards is author sustainability, as opposed to what I think is more of a, you know, which is more of a, it seems like some authors are just running so fast and putting out books so quickly that they're on a treadmill, right? And they're like, if I don't get 4 books out this year, 5 books out this year, 6 books out this year, I can't survive. And I'm like, no, you need to slow down. You need to write higher quality books that connect with people emotionally. And you need, again, get it into the hands of a few people. Let those people start spreading the word and then rinse and repeat. And so one of the things that I recommend to all authors, particularly because who knows what's going to happen with Amazon. Now, Amazon's been great to us. I have no qualms with Amazon. But, you know,
eggs in one basket.
Eggs in one basket. They could disappear at any time. So right. What do I recommend, right? So I tell authors, you should always have a direct sales channel to your readers, okay? Whether that be selling books off your website, and that could be ebooks as well as print books. Whether you do Kickstarters, which I'm sure will be a whole topic in just a moment. Mm-hmm. But what I really want to encourage authors to do is, again, they rely too much on kind of Amazon and their algorithms and people buying through, you know, KU, but they don't know any of those people. They don't have their email addresses. They don't know what they, I mean, the reason why Amazon is so good at what it does is it has the email address and the recorded of every single book you've ever bought. So it's really easy for them to say, if you like this, then you're going to like that. Okay. And so a lot of what I recommend for people is, you know, you have to insulate yourself from potential downfall. And that means having direct channels to your readership. And it means maybe charging a little bit more. I mean, people do not look, if I go to a Chipotle and I buy, you know, a burrito and a drink, you know, I'm over 10 bucks. So buying, spending 10 bucks on an ebook is not that hard of a thing to do. Now, most people would say, oh no, you know, I charge $2.99, $3.99, $4.99 for my ebooks. I'm like, yeah, that's all said and good. But, you know, we've never had a customer complain about the price of our books. No one has ever said to us, you know, oh my God, you know, that $9.99 I spent for your book was just, that was, that was a big waste of money.
You haven't had the problem yet. Now they're all going to call us.
Yeah. The number is. And so what I tell authors to do is, you know, really think of ways to maximize your income. And that might mean putting out fewer books a year. It might mean like just on a lark, because it's something that we wanted to do. We just finished a series, Legends of the First Empire, and I wanted to have a slipcase for it. And slipcases are a little expensive to create. There's dies and the construction is just a lot of manual labor and so forth. And I thought, well, if I want these, you know, maybe someone else would. And to be honest, I thought I might sell, you know, like the price break on these things, like get better at certain levels. Like, you know, if you get 100 slipcases, they're significantly cheaper than 200 slipcases, and 200 slipcases are significant, or 500 are significantly cheaper than 200. So I was just looking to bring down the price of the slipcase. So on a whim, I did a Kickstarter, and I thought I might get like 100, maybe 150 people, and I could do a production of slipcase runs. I had to order 1,100 of these things before I, before it was all said and done. Okay. And because people are buying them through a Kickstarter and because they're buying them directly from us, I don't have to give a cut to Amazon. I don't have to give a cut to the publishers. I charge customers, readers, fair prices. I do things to try and help people who are overseas because I know the shipping is expensive for them. So I give them some discounts and so forth. You know, I'm not trying to squeeze every cent I can out of a, out of a reader, but you know, I can see that very simple things, you know, will increase the author's income so that they don't have to write 5 books a year. I mean, if you run a couple Kickstarters and you earn well from those, you don't have to write as quickly. I mean, Mike, we'll put out a book a year, you know, over the next 3 years. And, you know, we're going to be able to live just fine on that.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things that, that to me is really interesting about what you're talking about is really almost, you know, an author reader relationship of, of trust, you know, but, you know, it's maybe something we don't think or talk about as much in sort of our very digital world.
Because there's this real separation with KU, right?
Yeah. Right,
I mean, they're
right.
they're just a bunch of people, you know, whale readers out there, like picking stuff up. They don't, I don't think that there is this personal connection. When we do a Kickstarter, people actually write messages on our Kickstarters and say, thank you for doing this. Thank you for involving us in this.
As part of our Kickstarters, we've had people actually come out here and spend the weekend.
Yeah.
And like lots of them.
Yeah.
So yeah, it gets personal.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we never lose sight of the fact that none of this would be possible if not for the readers. And we're always extremely grateful and thankful for all that they do. And I think they feel like they know us and we get to know them a lot through their emails. I mean, we encourage emails. Sometimes we get too many emails, but you know, I just think that that direct connection is really important.
Another thing that Robin had me do, which is kind of weird, but she had me do the author's note at the beginning of my book. Now I have a wonderful narrator and I think he did the very first one at some point, but then after that I did all my narration for those, which, and I'm not a public speaker, I'm not very good at it, but it was something I felt that we should do in order to make sure that, you know, the reader could actually hear my voice or the listener could hear my voice. And a lot of people have let me know that that was something that helped them. I think one person said they felt that made me feel real to them, whereas all the other authors were these, you know, fantasy creatures that created output. But since they actually heard my voice speaking to them, that was something that made a connection.
Wow. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense. So then, you know, with kind of this in mind, in terms of the, you know, some of the ideas and logistics and even philosophy behind self-publishing, you know, Michael, in your writing process, has your writing process shifted, you know, from, or did it ever shift from self-publishing to more traditional publishing, back to self-publishing, or has your process kind of remained steady and the same through all of that?
How I write books, you mean?
Yeah.
No, you have to understand that the books I write sometimes years in advance.
Yeah.
And right, then how they're, I mean, I wrote books that turned out to be self-published when I planned them to be traditionally published and vice versa. I mean, those decisions are made well after the fact. So I don't ever have that as an issue.
Yeah. When Michael started his Legends of the First Empire series, I thought there wasn't a chance anywhere in the world that they would be traditionally published. I could not envision us going traditionally published again. But then Del Rey came along. They were very respectful. They gave us an incredible offer. They gave us everything we wanted. Well, they gave us more than what we wanted. And I said, yeah, well, why not? You know, now that said, I really, really, really don't think there's anything that's going to get us back into traditional. But that has more to do with the fact, you know, Mike talked about the audio rights and how Penguin mm-hmm. Random House had this policy now where they need the audio rights. Well, it's not just Penguin Random House. It is Big Five across the board. And
sure.
And they're just and you know, way back in the day, audio rights were nothing. Like, I remember the first time we sold audio rights, which actually we had no say over it. Orbit sold them as a subsidiary deal. We got like $1,000 for those audio rights. I was mm-hmm. like, oh, okay, well, $1,000. Woohoo, oh, nice. You know, nice, whatever. Now, you know, we will get six figures for a single audio contract.
Yeah. Yeah. Audio books are, I mean, absolutely huge,
as
you know, as a market right now. And it, from my perspective, I really only see that continuing. I don't know if that's a trend that'll reverse. So,
it's certainly where all the growth is. And that's why the publishers want them so badly and why they won't let them go.
But we saw this with ebooks. I mean, ebooks became the trend and, and that's when they gobbled up those rights. And then eventually now we moved on to the audio. Who knows what'll be next? But
it may be in the future, you know, that there's some semi low cost way where you can kind of produce something that resembles an animated movie or something, you know, and that becomes a storytelling medium in the future. I don't know, but yeah, it's definitely where it is. And again, in telling authors of how to, you know, make it so they don't have to be running so fast, you know, part of that is exploiting the audio rights in the way that, you know, gives the greatest percentage to the author. I mentioned that Orbit sold our audio rights for the Rhaer Revelations as a subsidiary deal. And because there's so many people in the pie in that equation, there's Orbit, there's recorded books, there's Audible mm-hmm, Studios, mm-hmm. there's us, there's their agent. We get like 3.5% of those sales. Whereas audio deals we do now, we get 20% of the sales. So, you know, there's a huge difference there.
Yeah, that's significant. Right. Right. Now you had mentioned, a few minutes ago, kind of the concept of Kickstarters, and you have obviously done a lot with that in terms of the final several books of the Legends of the First Empire series, and I imagine future books as well. So do you have any kind of baseline advice for self-pubbed authors who may be looking to launch campaigns on Kickstarter?
Sure. So the first thing I would say is, I do not think that Kickstarter is a good venue for a debut author. Now, that said, I have backed a lot of debut authors because I like supporting people within that community. But that's very hard. It is much better for an author who's already has something out there. And I don't care whether that person is self-published or traditionally published. Interestingly enough, the way we got involved in Kickstarter is we had a friend who was traditionally published. And he wrote a new series and his agent shopped it around and no one would pick it up. And so he put it into a drawer. And I said, well, why don't you self-publish that? And he says, well, you know, if I'm going to self-publish, I would need to do it right. I'd have to hire cover artists. I'd have to hire editors. And, you know, I just don't have, you know, I'm kind of going book to book right now on my traditional contracts. I don't have spare money for doing that. And I said, well, why don't you run a Kickstarter to raise the money and then do the books? You've already, you're a traditionally published author. You already have a fan base. If you tell them you have a new book, I'm sure they'll be interested. He says, no, that will never work. So my very first Kickstarter was really only to prove to this author, you know, how successful they can be. And what I discovered was that there's a huge community that never had heard of Michael in the Kickstarter community who are always looking for new books and new projects to support. I mean, there are these people called super backers that they just spend their days looking for things to back.
The book she's talking about that we launched was Hollow World, which is, first of all, it's fairly early on in my career. I had just gotten published. And second, it's a science fiction book that no one was particularly interested in publishing anyway, which is why we Kickstarted it.
Right.
So the other author we were talking to wasn't bigger or more famous than they were.
You were not well known when we launched that.
No, I wasn't well known. And on top of that, I was putting out a book that wasn't even in the genre that I would be known for. So, and yet it worked phenomenally.
Yes. So I would say, you know, do some publishing first. I don't care whether it's self or traditional. You know, start getting a fan base, you know, start building your email list and do your direct selling on your website so that you have some people you can reach out to when you launch a Kickstarter. I always recommend that people launch a Kickstarter sometime midweek, like on a Tuesday, and always end it like on a Thursday or a Friday. I think less days are better than more days. Like, I think the maximum you can do on Kickstarter is like a month. Never run a Kickstarter for a month. It'll just drive you insane. You know, some of my shortest Kickstarters, I think, have been 2 weeks. And sometimes they've been, you know, like 21 days just because of how a holiday fell or something of that nature. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The reality is there's a lot, every Kickstarter, there's a lot of excitement at the beginning. There's a lot of excitement at the end. And during the middle is kind of the doldrums. And it'll just drive you crazy if you're like watching your Kickstarter and like nothing's moved that day. You know, it'll just get you depressed and, you know,
and almost always in the Kickstarter, it's like the middle part, nothing happens.
Yeah.
Right. A lot happens at the beginning. A lot happens at the end. And the middle part is like, why are you even bothering?
So the middle part. But that said, you know, there are tools, like one of the tools we use is BackerKit. Although right now I've changed over to PledgeBox. These are tools that allow you to kind of like allow people to participate in the Kickstarter after it's over. So like that Kickstarter I just mentioned for the slipcases, I think the original Kickstarter ended with like, I don't know exactly, but maybe like 850 people in it. But since the Kickstarter ended, I've been doing something called a manual ad because there's always these people saying, oh, I missed the Kickstarter. I'm so bummed. I'm like, well, you can still get in. We haven't shipped yet. And so we do manual ads to get people in. And now we're up over, I think we've got like 1,050 people who have come into it. So several hundred people have added after the fact. So I highly recommend that if you do a Kickstarter, you have a means either by PledgeBox or BackerKit so that you can add people even after it's over. And I also recommend, you know, don't make your pledge amount too small because then it's like, well, why are you running a Kickstarter? Right. Like if you're running a Kickstarter and you say, I want $500, my response would be, well, why don't you just stop going out to dinner for however long it takes you to save $500 and then publish your book? Right. So it has to be for, you know, a decent amount. And really, I think the most important thing about the Kickstarter is your story. And I don't mean the story you've written to sell. I mean your story as to why you're an author to begin with, or why you're doing the Kickstarter. You know, what moves you? What motivates you? What is your, you know, what is your why? like smiling here, because so there's this guy called Simon Sinek. He did a tech talk, which is a great 18-minute watch. It's called How Leaders Inspire Action or something of that nature. Just look up Simon Sinek on TED Talk. And he really has a great way of articulating that people don't care about what you make. They care about why you make it. And so if you kind of express your why, that really resonates with people. So I think just being very personable, being very honest, being
genuine is what
genuine. Yes. Thank you. Genuine.
Also, one more very key thing you want to try and do if you're trying to produce a Kickstarter, particularly if you're a fantasy author, try and do it the same week that Brandon Sanderson is doing his. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a winning strategy.
Well, no, it's funny because actually, you know, I know the people at Kickstarter very well. And when I told them I was launching a slipcase, they said, well, we've got a big Kickstarter that's coming out, whatever date it was. And they said, you probably want your Kickstarter running while that's going on. And actually, I was like, well, don't I want mine to be over before this gets on? And, you know, I didn't know. And I actually extended my Kickstarter longer. It was a 21-day Kickstarter when I wanted to do 14. And it did have that little bit of crossover with Brandon's. And sure enough, I got a huge bump. Like, when Brandon's Kickstarter hit, just because people were out of the system
I have a feel these people didn't know what Kickstarter was, and then suddenly went, oh, look at this. And then went, what else is here?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And matter of fact, that guy
I know
that we met at the restaurant, we got him
because of the Brandon Sanders
Kickstarter.
Wow.
So again, Kickstarter has its own community and people are just looking for things. So you would think, well, you know, if I do a Kickstarter, I'm only selling to my fans. Well, we found that we only get like 30% of the people in the Kickstarter were people that were existing readers. 70% of them were people who had never heard about Mike before.
Yeah, there are people who are just part of the Kickstarter community.
Yeah.
And so you get to tap a whole new audience when you do that.
Right.
And now, see, that's something I never would have imagined that you know... I mean, I've backed various projects on Kickstarter or whatnot, but to imagine that there's kind of that's a community to be tapped, that's a different perspective. That's really interesting.
Yeah, there's all these communities on the internet. I mean, there's Goodreads and there's Reddit and there's, you know, I suppose Facebook, although we don't do as much there, and of course, you know, Kickstarter. So yeah, these are different communities, and they're not. I mean, they have crossovers, but I think that if you go to each one, you increase your potential of getting new readers.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's this is so cool. when things I read a ton of self-published fantasy novels, and I interact with a lot of authors, obviously through Twitter and interviews on the podcast here and all of those sorts of things. And so, you know, it's neat for me and listeners to kind of see and hear all of this different, these kind of different takes or whatnot. So thank you very much for that. Now I'm curious, we've talked a lot about the benefits of an author sort of interacting with, with readers and putting out your story and being genuine and that kind of thing. Are there ways in which you find as an author, maybe not, but are there ways in which, Michael, you find as an author interacting with fans? Does that Does that give you a different perspective on things? Not that it changes what you're writing, right? But does it give you a perspective on your writing, or encouragement, or just other elements as you have the opportunity to interact through emails or through, you know, whatever?
Well, Robin would be able to tell you this pretty easily, but I don't think I've ever really worked for a paycheck. Not intentionally. I mean, I did, but the fact of the matter is that was not my motivating factor. I had gotten a job where I had a 40% increase in pay within the first 6 months, and then 6 months later I quit. Not because they weren't paying me well, but because I didn't feel that they respected what I was doing. I function much better on people who like what I'm doing or appreciate what I'm doing, and people who let me know that do give me, you know, the fuel that I need to work. So when I get email from people, when I have individuals who, you know, who I meet on, we actually ran into one that she was talking about yesterday or just a few minutes ago about how a guy at a restaurant knew me and he wanted to come out. He worked in the kitchen. And he wanted to come out the restaurant and talk to me. That sort of thing is incredible because that generally doesn't happen. But when I get to talk to people and they get to telling me, the best thing is when you write something and there are certain things in what you write that you think are great, but sometimes they're pretty subtle and you're certain that no one else is going to see what it is you wanted them to see. And I mean, certain things you do, a lot of things you think they're not going to get it. You know, they're just going to miss the whole point of why you're doing this whole thing. But when they write to you or when they talk to you and they say back to you exactly what you were hoping they would, that is a rub. That is the applause that the author never gets to hear because he's not on a stage.
Yeah. But, and the other thing I want to say along these lines, you know, like right now, you have no idea how many times we've gotten letters that say, you know, I found your books in a really bad time of my life and you really helped me out. I mean, there are people who, you know, were going to commit suicide, but then because certain characters of Michael's kept like putting off suicide and their life got turned around, they thought it was like a sign, you know, they actually thought it was a sign to them. And right now during COVID, I can't, you know, the emails have increased about, you know, thank you for giving me, you know, a respite from, you know, from these hard times of mine. And I'm glad I'm able to escape into it and so forth. And you know, and again, in some respects, that kind of goes back to this whole direct connection with the reader standpoint. I mean, we actually encourage readers to write to us, you know. I do an afterword in Michael's books, and I got my own fans. Like, they write to me, you know, Robin, I just want to tell you how much I like the afterword and stuff. And you know, and again, you know, we encourage that, and people, Mike just did a video for a guy who had a friend who had a baby and named it after one of Michael's characters. And this guy wrote to Michael and said, could you please do a little video for him, you know, saying something about it. And Mike took, it was like, I don't know, a minute or so, maybe a little bit more.
Well, after I had all the makeup done and the hair.
and he did this little video and the friend, you know, was just thrilled. And he said the guy that got it was, you know, entirely thrilled. So, you know, again, well, and like we talked about Goodreads a moment ago, you know, from time to time, Mike will go on Goodreads and just look for a review. And when he sees a review like he was talking about, where that person really got what he was saying, he'll put a little comment, you know, back to that person on Goodreads. You know, I'm so glad you saw what I was going for. You know, I never know whether people do, yada, yada, yada. And then, the reader's all excited. Oh, my God, the author wrote to me. And you know they're telling all their friends, you know, oh my God, the author wrote to me. And the friends are like, wow, you know, a writer's never written to me, you know, wouldn't that be cool? And so I think, you know, and I don't want to go back to Simon Sinek, but it's all about this, you know, this way of connecting with people where you're not selling them something. You are, you're relating to them and you're
standing up for what you believe in, and other people see that and they say, you know what? I believe that too.
Yeah.
And exactly. Then they want to buy your stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I respond well to praise. Doesn't everyone? And so, sure, that's something that does motivate me a great deal more than anything else. I mean, there was a time when I wrote my last book of the Ryer Revelations, and it was just discovered that I was going to be publishing through Random or through Orbit at the time. And when that happened, a number of people who were supporting me because I was self-published got very upset. They sold out.
No, but there was a delay. Remember
yes,
that?
There was every book was coming out every 6 months until that point, and they wanted a year to put that last book out. So they felt betrayed by me, and I got all kinds of hate posts on my website. It was like the single biggest post today of my website.
When he says all kinds, he means 10.
30.
Okay, 30.
Yeah, I know. Well, I was small back then. So it was something that was kind of devastating, and I got very upset, and I was just going to stop writing because I wasn't going to go do this anymore. If I didn't have people who wanted to read it, I wasn't going to be putting it out for him. So that's why it is very important. It is the fuel that I work on.
At the time, I still had a day job, and I came home and found Mike sitting in a darkened room watching Duck Soup, and I knew he was in a very bad place. Interestingly enough, a lot of people later wrote back and said, "I'm really sorry."
Oh, well, see, I was told really not to respond by the publisher, and after a couple weeks, I said, "Screw that."
Yeah, Mike doesn't listen to publishers very well.
So then I actually explained everything. And when I did that, then most of the people there
apologized.
You know, well, they flailed themselves.
They did. One guy in particular flailed himself.
One person actually said that he was going to buy all my books but not read any of them because he doesn't deserve to.
Oh, gosh.
You're going too far.
Wow. I've seen stuff like that happen, you know, online, you know, kind of watching from the sidelines, as it were. And it's interesting to hear the perspective, kind of the author perspective on that sort of thing. And you know, I mean, online, the internet, you know, folks can be vicious, but it's also cool to hear that folks have been willing to come back and say, "Hey, yeah, you know."
Well,
my bad.
One person that turned me around on that was I was watching Duck Soup, I was watching Marx Brothers, and I got an email from one of my readers and said, "You shouldn't be so upset because you have to realize that no one would care if they didn't really love your stories."
Mm.
And that was like, okay, you know, I hadn't thought of it from that perspective, but all right, that makes it a little better.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and obviously you have a ton of folks who love your stories because they're great and awesome. So
at least I did until I did this little talk.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah.
Once they found out he's sitting in a room watching Duck Soup, they want nothing to do with him anymore.
This guy.
That's right.
Pathetic.
That's right. Oh, wow. 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 Well, thank you both so much for offering your thoughts and you know, your perspectives and your stories and all of this. This has been incredible.
Wasn't the show supposed to be like 12 minutes long?
Yeah, you know, but that's okay. That's okay. Well, post-production, right? Post-production.
We're sorry. We talk a lot.
No, it's awesome. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate your time and everything else. So if folks, you know, want to learn more about you, or maybe this is the first time, I don't know how, but maybe this is the first time they're hearing about Michael J. Sullivan, where can they go to learn more about you?
All right. This public service announcement will come from my wife. She does it so much better.
So Michael has three series that he has released. The first is called The Ryer Revelations. It's about a cynical thief who's paired up with a idealistic mercenary. And it starts off pretty simply, and then it turns into an epic advancer. Epic adventure.
Okay, I take it back. She's not good at
this. She's not good at that. His most recent series is called Legends of the First Empire. It just completed this May. We also have a prequel to the Ryer Revelations called the Ryer Chronicles. Those kind of take the main characters of the Ryer Revelations and then shows how they first met And they're kind of more standalone stories. The Rye-Ear Revelations has a very intricately woven plot where the entire series fits together in a very interesting tapestry. And Rye-Ear Chronicles are kind of like standalones. They're easier to digest. Mm-hmm. And right now he's working on a new series. It's called The Rise and the Fall. The first two books are written. He started writing the third book
Monday.
So he's hoping to be done with that by the end of the fall. Or no, by the end of this year, you're going to have that one done.
Right.
And the first book in that should come out August of next year. And of course, we will be running a Kickstarter for it, as we're going to kickstart everything. You know, our website is terrible and is under revamp.
You want to give them the URL?
I'm almost embarrassed too, but yeah, so it's, there's two websites. One is called Rye-Ear, R-I-Y-R-I-A. So www.ryeera.com. There's another one called, First Empire Series. And obviously those should be under one, which is one of the reasons why I don't even want to mention it. Cause it's like, it's such a mess that we have two websites. And technically Mike's on Facebook, but he doesn't check it very often. And sometimes we see a post where someone's trying to ask us a question out there, and it's like, oh.
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of things. I jump in, and I'm like, oh, Mike, this is from 2008.
Yeah. So, but direct mail, we like the, you know, the emails, so that would be Michael. Yeah,
those are the ones we tend to respond to.
Yeah. Email is something that is dealt with on a daily basis, and that's michael.sullivan.dc, like District of Columbia, @gmail.com.
Awesome. And again, thank you both so much for your time and your willingness to come on and talk with me this evening.
Well, it was really hard, and I'm trying to get over the flashbacks I'll have tonight. But yeah, I think we can do it. It's okay. You're welcome. And it was fun.
It was fun.
You've been a very good interviewer. I like making you stumped and laugh. So that's always fun.
Well, it's the pleasure is all mine. So thank you.
All right.
Have a good night. Whoosh, whoosh.